This is CliffCentral.com.
Any opportunity I can get to talk to people who are extremely clever and extremely focused in an area that I don't understand a damn thing about, I take. I love to meet people who are at the forefront of pushing the latest in technology and in the development of theory, in the development of practice and application of that theory. And the two women that I have in the studio this morning are in every way, shape, and form, precisely of that description, Dr. Marilise Ewerts and Harshna Jivan, who are both female scientists. Now, I mean, the reason I indicate that you are female scientists, because I think scientists should be enough, but the reason I bring that up in that particular context is because the Women in Science program is what we're really talking about. Both of our guests have been recognized in the Women in Science program. It's a partnership by UNESCO and the L'Oréal Foundation for the last 20 years to honor laureates for their scientific achievements. Of the 102 that have received this honor, 3 have gone on to receive Nobel Prizes. So no pressure, ladies. Good heavens. First of all, congratulations on being part of this program. It shouldn't be the exception, really, but it's through no fault of women or of men, necessarily, that there are so few women who are in the sciences. It's something that I think is probably interesting politically, and especially to people who are interested in pursuing some kind of equity, that they think it's important that, you know, there are 50% women and 50% men in everything. And, of course, that's never going to happen. I mean, Marilise, I believe that you studied mechanical and aeronautical engineering, and there couldn't have been a lot of women in your class when you started, right?
No, not at all. And each year as my studies progressed, the amount of women just decreased. And when I graduated with my PhD last year, I was the only female who graduated with mechanical engineering.
Now, politicians would ask you why. I'm more interested in what it was that you were studying that made you last, because people make various decisions through the course of a degree, and particularly going all the way to PhD level, and maybe your interests change, and some people perhaps don't retain an interest in a certain subject. There are these generalities that we find in society that women prefer people and men prefer things. It's a generality, obviously. It's not always true. But in the case of what you were studying, I mean, what were the reasons that the other women didn't stay till the end like you did, and what makes you so exceptional?
Well, I never planned to continue my studies up to postgraduate level or even to think about an academic career. I think most of us just aim to finish, obtain our degree and then go to industry.
Yeah.
But during my final year research project, I actually realized that I really enjoyed research. And then my supervisor started talking about doing postgraduate, and mm-hmm. then he encouraged me to do honors the next year. And then, well, the honors turned into a master's, the master's into a PhD, the PhD into the postdoc, and now that's turning into an academic career.
It's amazing. I mean, it kind of consumes you eventually, right?
Yes, but doing research is really my passion, and although I'm not lecturing yet, I'm already supervising postgraduate students, and yeah, it's really satisfying to be able to transfer my knowledge, but also to be able to expand it on a daily basis.
So you get the best of both worlds, because you get to deal with young inquiring minds and people who are as interested in engineering as you are. And at the same time, you get to do the research yourself, which means you are the scientist and the teacher.
Yes.
Brilliant.
I don't think there's a more suitable career for me.
<That's>
I found
great.
My happy place.
That's very, very cool. Now, Harshna, it's nice to meet you. Your story is that you lost your dad when you were 5 months old, and your mom raised you and your sister
yes.
as a single parent, which is never easy, and there are lots of people in this country who've had to walk that path. But you grew up with a different sort of perception of gender roles in a family. Is that because your mom did everything?
Yes, exactly. So I come from Indonesia.
Yes.
And back then I felt like there were specific gender roles that parents typically tended to play.
Mm.
But I didn't feel like I grew up that way, because my mom had to do everything,
right.
and she did that working role. And
sure.
so, yeah. Also, I came from a house full of females, because we're mostly
sure.
females. I lived with my grandmother and her sister, my mom and her sister, me and my sister. Yeah, so it was...
Were you frightened the first time you met men?
Well, okay, I did grow up with my grandfather initially,
yeah.
but yeah.
So you graduated at the University of the Witwatersrand. You decided to pursue a PhD for your MSc dissertation. You worked on characterizing radiation damage in plastic scintillator detectors for the tile calorimeter of the Atlas detector at CERN in South Africa.
Actually, not in South Africa.
In Switzerland.
At Switzerland, yes.
Oh, okay, but you studied this here, and you've been to CERN.
Yes, I got the lucky opportunity to spend 3 months. It was amazing. It was a great opportunity, and I was lucky that it was during the shutdown period. So I actually got to see, go down into the cavern and see the LHC ring, see the Atlas detector, and see one of the other detectors called the CMS detector. It was really awesome. I was mind blown.
I want to talk about that in a second, but since I've explained what it is that your area of specialization is, I think I should only, out of fairness, refer to what Marilise's is. Marilise, you are involved in heat transfer and pressure drop of high viscosity fluids in solar receiver tubes. That's what you did for your PhD.
Yes, and I'm continuing with that during my postdoc.
So what is – okay, first of all, let's start with heat transfer. I think that's – so if something, let's say, is heated by solar radiation, you would measure the heat transfer through a liquid, a solid, or a gas that you're trying to – Is it osmotic? Is it to do with whether or not that is a super absorptive fluid or something? It could take the heat away. Do you just measure the rate of that transfer of heat? What do we do with this heat? What's the purpose of this?
So for our experiments, what we actually do is we let water flow through a tube. Mm-hmm. And then on the tube, we have several measuring stations where you measure the temperature and the pressure drop. So on my test section, I have 108 thermocouples, which I use to measure the temperature at the different points along the tube length. And then I also have 9 places where I can measure the pressure drop. And then from the temperature and the pressure drop measurements, I calculate the heat transfer coefficients and friction factors. And from this information, I develop equations that can be used to design heat transfer devices that has many applications.
What's the initial source of this heat?
So I heat the tube.
Okay, you heat it up.
Electrical heating.
Okay, right.
Yes.
Okay, to what sort of temperatures?
I like to keep things safe, so I don't exceed temperatures above 60 degrees for now.
Are we water in the tube?
During my PhD, I conducted experiments with water, but now during my postdoc, I'm changing the fluid to propylene glycol in order to change the viscosity and also expand the equations.
So that's obviously a bit more viscous. It's a bit lighter.
It's more like oil compared to water.
Okay, and with water, temperature and pressure, the relationship is that the higher the temperature, usually the higher the pressure in a closed space with water. Is that true for propylene glycol as well?
Yeah, so now with the glycol, because it's more viscous, the pressure drops increases significantly. So now all of a sudden I had to get a larger pump, a larger flow meter. So everything is...
Is this a huge setup?
Yes, it's quite a big setup, and I built it myself. So it was a huge privilege for me to be able to, basically the first year of my PhD, I spent designing an entire state-of-the-art setup and also building it myself. So when something goes wrong, I immediately know where to start looking for it.
So these containers, these tubes have to be of consistent... They have to have a consistent strength and I suppose consistency, for want of a better word, across the entire measurement surface, right?
Yeah. So usually
you use glass.
No, we use copper tubes.
Copper tubes.
Because it's easy to
same
heat
thickness?
As well. It's a 1/2-inch copper tube with a wall thickness of about 0.6 millimeters.
Okay.
And it's usually about 6 meters long. But for my research, I required a much longer tube, so they specifically made one for me, which is 10 meters long.
Do you have a room big enough for this?
Yes. The room is big enough, but it was quite ambition to get the tube inside the room.
I'll bet, because you couldn't cut it up and then put it back together
again. No, not at all. And then it was quite a mission to get it into the lab.
How did you do it? Through the windows?
No, not through the windows, but we had to go through the parking garage.
Oh, wow.
And we couldn't use the stairs, so half of the people had to be downstairs and the other half of the people had to be upstairs. And then when the tube was finally into the lab, and everybody left, and I was so excited the week was successful, I realized it's 180 degrees the wrong side.
Oh, God, so you had to turn it around.
So I went home, and then the Monday morning, I had to get a bunch of people, had to maneuver it to turn it around.
People think science is all glamorous and quiet and, you know, all about research and thinking and looking at stories and books and researching stuff on the internet. And meanwhile, it's moving pipes up. What is the ultimate purpose of this heat transfer experiment? What are you hoping to learn?
Well, I already developed several correlations, which is basically equations that are used by engineers to design heat transfer equipment. And
where would this be useful? Would this be useful in power generation? Would it be useful in plumbing? I mean, I'm trying to think of applications here.
So the nice thing about my research is it's very fundamental, so the applications are very wide. It's from domestic systems such as air conditioners in cars and buildings, to water heaters and chillers, to renewable energy systems such as solar heating, to industrial systems such as the mining and power generation. But then another part of my research is I'm addressing a lot of fundamentals that previous people didn't understand or actually even know of before.
Yeah.
So what is really exciting is some of my latest findings are being published in a heat transfer textbook this month in the United States of America. And this heat transfer textbook is used by universities all over the world, including our university, the University of Pretoria. So for me, it's really nice to realize that, okay, the impact of my research is not only limited to our university or our country or continent. It really has a global impact.
Well, do you feel the same way about the stuff you're doing, Harshna?
Yes. what I'm doing is a little bit more fundamental, but I think it has a lot of applications. So actually, the stuff that you were talking about earlier was what I did in my master's.
Okay.
But I kind of shifted projects
for
my PhD.
What are you busy with at the moment?
So I'm currently doing nuclear structure physics experiments.
Wow. Yes. Are we talking about subatomic particles here?
Well, just protons and neutrons while we're investigating the nucleus. So that's
by no means boring. Okay.
No, it's pretty cool. Basically...
Just explain to me. I've been desperate to have a scientist in here to explain to me how the quarks work and how they transfer their value to each other in order to keep the nucleus together. Because it bothered me for the longest time that you've got in the middle of the atom, you've got this nucleus, which is filled with only positive and neutral particles.
Yes.
And yet it stays together. They should repel each other just like they attract the electrons.
Exactly.
So how does it stay together?
So that's kind of what I'm trying to study. Well, not entirely, but like everything we do that all nuclear structure physicists do is trying to build towards understanding the nuclear strong force.
It's like a universal model, right? Oh, yes. The nuclear strong force.
Yes.
Okay. So we got four forces in the world. There's gravity, there's electromagnetism, there's the strong nuclear and the weak nuclear.
Yes.
So you're studying the strong nuclear force.
Yes. Okay. So basically, if you think of protons and neutrons, we think that they're different from each other. But actually, a proton would just be, between the two, there's up quarks and down quarks. So one is consisted of two up quarks and
a down.
So
imagine each proton or neutron with three things inside it.
Yes. So let's imagine that three of us are kind of quarks, right?
Okay.
And we're throwing a little ball between, well, each of us has a ball going between us. So three of us have this ball, right? We call that ball a gluon.
Okay.
Because it kind of makes everything stick together.
Right.
Okay. So within the nucleus, the protons and neutrons kind of act as bound systems of three quarks throwing together gluons between them. But it's very easy for me to just decide, okay, I don't feel like throwing a ball between you guys. I'm going to find someone else. And there's lots of quarks in this mix. So as soon as I start throwing it with another down and up quark, I could form. So that's how you can convert from proton to a neutron.
So a neutron has two downs and one up.
Yes.
And a proton has two ups and one down.
Actually, I'm not sure which one is which
right
now.
But okay,
basically,
if we're throwing the ball between ourselves and then you decide you don't want to play anymore,
I decide to go and find some other quarks to throw it. So some other quark will come in my place. But that's how you can convert between a proton to a neutron. So within the nucleus, it's actually just
moving the whole time.
Yes.
So in other words, that positive charge is never restive.
No. It's not.
This is fascinating. I'd imagine that when you are at CERN and you're watching all these experiments where they're trying to effectively break things to ever smaller pieces and then read what comes out of that.
Yeah, so have you seen
on the screen evidence of all of this?
We see evidence of what comes out of a collision, but I mean, you can't physically see it with
your eye. No. But you can see.
You see signatures, and that's the most amazing part about science. It's like, for me, it's like magical, because it's like, I can't really see it, but there's signatures for it. There's evidence that it's there.
Yeah.
And, you can, like, look at the interaction of particles through detectors. So, for instance, like, if you have a particle which carries a lot of energy, you can pass it through something called a scintillator, a plastic scintillator. Oh, well, just a scintillator.
This is kind of what you did in your master's thesis,
yes,
right?
And, scintillators form the basis of most detection systems. You get different kinds of...
Just to explain what a scintillator is to a complete
idiot. Okay, so a scintillator is just something that basically, like, when you have a particle with energy, it will interact with the molecules within this scintillator thing.
It would be like watching...
It could be a crystal or...
It would be like watching a bubble move through a liquid.
Yes, kind of. You could think of that, but then you start seeing more bubbles in the liquid, and it's like it starts interacting with other bubbles in the liquid. And what happens is that it will give its energy off to molecules within that crystal or whatever it is, and these things will absorb that energy. But, like, imagine if I'm just this being and I have so much of energy. Mm-hmm. I need to lose that energy somehow, so I can become super hyper and start dancing around to lose that energy. And in the same way, these atoms will or molecules will get excited, and then they de-excite by emitting like a gamma ray, which we can measure as being a beam of light, a small little wisp of light.
Right.
Yes. And that's actually how you can measure the energy coming out of the system.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. And you can then like get very intricate information about what kind of experiment you just did. And that's also what I'm doing in my PhD. It's kind of like playing pool, but instead of having your white ball hitting your color ball and things going off, instead you just like give energy to the ball you hit and watch it vibrate and then watch what comes out as it loses the vibration.
And we measure
the
that. What molecules do you use in these scintillators?
Okay, so in my specific case for my PhD, it's actually a target of an element, an isotope of samarium. So the element is samarium, and I look at two different isotopes of it. So an isotope just means that it has the same number of protons in the nucleus, but more neutrons.
Mm-hmm.
And the one Samarium's, with less...
Samarium's one of the lanthanides.
Yes.
It's somewhere between, what, 60... how many protons are in there? I mean, I'm trying to remember this. There we go, 62. Okay.
Yes. So basically, when the nucleus gets a lot of neutrons, it becomes heavier. So the one isotope I'm looking at is spherical in shape, like a soccer ball.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm looking at another one which has extra neutrons.
Is that radioactive?
No, these are stable isotopes, so they don't naturally
decompose.
Emit.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm comparing... Samarium,
so samarium is then like a... It's almost a foundational tool that you use to then observe other things around it.
Yeah, so the reason we're looking at samarium is because it has a lot of stable isotopes.
Okay.
And we're trying to compare how the nuclear deformation changes the property of the nucleus.
Wow.
So I'm comparing the spherical case to the prolate case. A prolate nucleus is basically like a rugby ball shape nucleus. Yeah.
This is amazing. So what you are doing is you're looking at things that are so tiny you'll never see them.
Yes.
But you're looking for evidence that they exist in these.
Yes.
In these scintillators.
Well, so the detectors that I use, I have two different kinds. I've got one that's called the lanthanum bromide detector, which is a scintillating crystal.
Right.
And another one is a germanium detector, so it's made up of a germanium crystal as well.
Mm-hmm.
But this one works with a slightly different... It doesn't emit light. Instead, it works like where if a particle with energy comes in, it will hit...
It will reflect it?
It almost hits the little atoms inside, which will emit their electrons. And then you end up having like a cascade of electrons, and you can measure the charge of that cascade of electrons.
Is it almost like a non-nuclear chain reaction? Like an electron chain reaction.
Yes, it's not nuclear. It's an atomic. You're knocking out the electrons only. You're not messing with the nuclear
Does that start a current or a charge, or is there nothing for it to flow down?
A little current.
Okay.
And then these detectors have to be cryogenically cooled. So they have to be in these these little casings with liquid nitrogen pumping through it.
And you can see through the casing?
Yeah. No, you can't see through the casing.
Who's got the biggest lab here? I mean, this sounds like something where there's a competition. If you have cryogenics and...
Well, I mean, it's not like the lab belongs to me. I actually use... it's a national facility that we have here.
It's at the bottom of Empire Road.
So that's actually the Gauteng branch, Itemba Labs. Mm-hmm. But there's one in Cape Town. Actually in Fora. It's more closer to Stellenbosch.
Okay.
There we've got a cyclotron as well.
Really? Yeah, like a mini CERN?
Very mini. Okay. Very mini. It fits in one little, not one little, but like maybe, the size of this building.
That's not small. So
it's not small.
I know you've been to Switzerland, but don't poo-poo it.
No, I'm not. It's amazing. The facility we have is actually world-class.
What kind of stuff can we do with that cyclotron?
There's so many things that they do at the lab, actually, besides just fundamental nuclear physics experiments.
Sure.
There's also a lot of isotope production. In fact, Itemba Labs, I think, makes I think there's an element called strontium.
Yes.
That they produce, mm-hmm. and I think they supply about 30% of the medical isotope to the world.
They use strontium to detect cancer.
Yes, and then there was a time when the lab was also doing proton and neutron therapies for cancer.
Right. Yeah, do you deal with radioactive isotopes?
Yes, all the time. So it's a lot of radiation protection.
Sure.
Yeah, we've got to be very safe. There's a lot of safety protocols. Everything is like surrounded by concrete.
Yeah, how do you store this stuff?
In a lot of shielding. There's a big program involved which takes into account all the sources, where they stay, how they're shielded.
And it's all lead shielding documented very carefully. Yeah, lead shielding. So you've got obviously lots of dangerous isotopes there, and you have to work in glove boxes and things like that too.
If you're directly dealing with touching it sometimes, I suppose, yes.
But normally you would just put it into something like the cyclotron and then use it for experimentation.
You don't put it in the cyclotron itself. So the cyclotron source actually starts off with a gas.
Oh, really?
Which they ionize.
Uh-huh.
Also, it depends on what kind of particle they're trying to accelerate.
Yeah.
But in my case, we accelerate alpha particles.
So helium nuclei.
Helium nuclei, yes. So two protons, two neutrons. So you take helium gas, pull out the electrons, and then we have a four-sector...
How do you pull out the electrons?
By giving a really strong charge.
A positive charge on the outside, and it just rips them off of the... It disintegrates helium? That's incredible. That's you're making alpha particles.
Electrons are not very committed to the atom.
No, they're not. We've discovered this, and we're not even sure whether they're particles or they're a cloud, right? We still don't know.
Yes, we consider them as being a fundamental particle.
But can we find them? I mean, we can...
Well, we have evidence for it in our electricity.
Yes, but we have no idea whether they have a fixed place in the...
No, they don't. I don't think that anything has a fixed place. We're too used to this world where we see things as being solid, but maybe if we could see at different frequencies or feel the vibrations, we'd realize that we ourselves could just disintegrate.
And technically, you could push one hand through the other. Because the space between these particles is greater than the particles themselves.
Yes, but if you knew how to overcome the strong forces and the weak forces.
Well, this is what you're working on. Listen, I'm sorry, Marlies, I'm just fascinated. This is like my favorite stuff in the world to talk about. This is fascinating. Yeah. So, okay, just to wrap up on this stuff.
Yes.
So you make these alpha particles.
Yes.
And then that's what you use as your source.
That's basically like my projectile. Okay. And then I bombard them onto the target. Yes, so we speed them up through this four-sector cyclotron, and then the particle comes through with a beam, hits onto the target, and then it sprays out the gamma particles. Also, the incoming alpha also gets emitted out, but there's lots of different nuclear reactions that happen, and then you have to be selective of which kind of channel you want. So through different kinds of detection methods, we can actually pick out just the information coming from the particular channel we're looking at. So I have like concurrent detectors, one measuring the alpha particles that come out. You can also have a proton coming out or deuteron coming out. Deuteron is basically like hydrogen with an extra neutron.
Right.
And then from...
Makes heavy water.
Yes. So, but in this case, just the nucleus.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you see the way it interacts with the detector, so like the heavier the particle, it will have, it will spend more time going through the detector. It will have a different path that it would travel, and it would give off a different amount of energy. So you can actually then select the ones that you can identify as alpha particles. And then I look for coincidence, which means I look for when there was an alpha hit and a gamma hit. Mm-hmm. And then I can back calculate to know exactly at which point the collision happened and what was the energy transfer there.
Wow.
Yes.
Isn't this amazing?
Wow.
So Marlies, with your stuff that you're busy figuring out, there's obviously going to be immediate practical application for this. I mean, do you have patents that you're looking to register around some of your discoveries? Are you under the auspices of the university in that respect? Do they claim the intellectual property, for example? I mean, how does it work at that level of academia and of research?
Well, I'm not really focusing on registering patents. For me, I'm focusing on understanding the fundamentals.
But if you make some breakthrough, as you have already, you've said some of your stuff gets put in textbooks. So who gets to own those breakthroughs? I mean, I know it's not important to scientists like it is to people in music, for example, you know, if you write a good melody. And it seems almost trivial because to you guys, you're discovering in your case the basic fundamental nature of matter. And in your case, the important relationship between heat and temperature and pressure and the ability of certain fluids to absorb this heat and where that can be applied. These are massively useful things compared to a song, but who owns it?
Well, all our findings are published in journal articles. And yes, we publish it. I publish with my supervisor, Professor Joshua Meyer, and we publish it as part of the University of Pretoria.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also disseminate lots of our research at international conferences across the world.
Is that scary? Because you scientists operate on peer review. So someone can come along and say, look, I've done the same experiment that you did, Marlies, and actually I've discovered something completely different. You're wrong.
Yeah, in the beginning it was absolutely nerve-wracking for me. Just my first conference, like, how am I supposed to be able to ask questions from professors? Because back then I was still a master's student. But as you progress with your research, you gain more confidence in your results. And then you realize, but yes, all of us might be, for example, mechanical engineers, but each of us has our speciality. And you can't really focus on everything. There's just too many things. So I'm an expert in my part, and he's an expert in his part. And then it's really amazing when we all come together and then start forming a huge project.
You guys can build Iron Man. I mean, so tell me quickly about this Women in Science program and what it means to you guys and how you feel about women in science. Because there are loads of opinions blowing all over the place. And as I said, politicians get involved. And frankly, I don't think they've got any business in science, because the people who definitely understand science the least are the politicians. But do we have a problem on not enough women in science? Does it matter that women are choosing not to be in science? Because often if it's their choice, who are you to get in the way? And with those women who do you really care how many other women are in science if you're busy doing the work you care about?
I think you should follow your heart. If you have a passion for research and for science, why do something else just because you're a female? I'm a mechanical engineer, and just because I'm a mechanical engineer, I'm not less female at all. I still wear dresses and heels. I love cooking and pink will always be my favorite color. That's not going to change.
I can't believe you have to defend your femininity. All right.
So for me, yeah, I just follow my heart, and it's actually a privilege for me to be able to encourage other female youngsters to also pursue careers in science and engineering, because I don't have a specific role model, and at first I was very hesitant to even go and study mechanical engineering because my perception was completely wrong. I thought it's a career for men only, mm-hmm. and it's filled with cars and gears and grease. And
and have men been supportive of you and helpful to you? You mentioned your supervisor, but do you ever find that there's an attitude from any of them that makes it more difficult for you?
Well, I did not really excel in my studies initially, but then as the years went by, I started enjoying it more and more. And then my results just became better. And then when I started like getting close to the top of the class, I experienced jealousy from the fellow male classmates because they didn't really like the fact that a female is outperforming them. But I didn't let this discourage me. I just continued to give my best, and the university actually really supported and encouraged me. And yeah, it turned out that I not only ended top of the class in the University of Pretoria, but I also graduated as the top engineering student in the country.
Wow. So, that's incredible. Congratulations. I really think that's amazing.
Much.
That's spectacular.
So, yeah, I think it's important.
One small step for a woman, one giant leap for humankind.
Yeah. So just follow your heart. If you have a passion, if that is part of you, if you have a talent for something, use it.
And I mean, Harshna, it's not as if there haven't been women in your field for the longest time. I mean, Marie Curie, in some ways, was the founder of understanding radiation.
Yes.
And she was probably the first person that we have a record of who would have died of radiation poisoning from studying these very alpha particles and beta and gamma particles that you were talking about.
I believe her daughter as well.
Yeah. Yes, her daughter and her husband, Pierre.
Yes.
But Marie Curie was, in so many ways, every step of every bit a scientist and every bit the wife and the woman and all of those things. So it's not as if this is something which is unusual. And there are minds, great scientific minds, that occur in males and in females. We
yes.
know this.
Yeah.
Do you feel the same as Marilise?
Yes, I think it's important that, like, from a young age, you just have role models that you can look up to or that you can see yourself fitting into their shoes. So you need them to be relatable. Mm. As a kid, I loved science, but I didn't think that physics was something I would actually get into. I thought, okay, like, bio is more the field for me. It seems like more like, you know, the flexible job. When you start painting a picture, or the picture that comes to your mind as a kid of what a physicist is, you picture this man with crazy hair and stuff, and then you picture the female in chemistry or in bio. And it was like, it was not something that I had considered until like my high school physics teacher. He used to always call me his physicist. And he really encouraged us to be in science fairs and things like that. So I think it's more about like just the influences you have in your life as growing up that encourage a certain behavior with you. And then in some cases you find that for some girls, maybe they don't have that encouragement. And perhaps that's why we need to step up and show them that, hey, right. you can do this. You can do – if you have your mind and your heart set on something, and usually at that age you don't really know what you want to do. I mean,
no, sure.
so – I think that, like, you just need some pushes in the right direction, or you just need to see somebody living that life and knowing that, hey, I like the elements of what they're doing. Maybe I could see myself doing that.
Showing that it's possible.
Yeah. So, I mean, I also had very few females in my class, even within our department. But now I'm surrounded by lots of females in, I don't know, it's somehow nuclear physics seems to attract females nowadays.
That's a very, isn't it amazing how these fields like mechanical engineering and nuclear physics, people used to denigrate them and say, oh, it's for nerds and it's not necessary.
Yeah, now that's everybody, more the thing about physics is more like, oh, you have to be an extreme nerd.
Yeah, I want to ask you something else about that in a second, but now it's kind of cool.
Yeah, exactly.
Like now everybody goes,
I think the Big Bang Theory
Big
did
Bang
a lot.
Big Bang Theory might have had to do with that. But it's also got to do with like the fact that people are fascinated by learning, and now learning is not a thing that's just for
academics,
you know, for the academics. It's something that everybody wants to have some grasp on. And I think that also, and this is what I wanted to get to with the discussion around men and women and everything else, I think a lot of guys and intimidated by a woman who is smart and who has a PhD in mechanical engineering, who is doing nuclear physics. Because I think for a lot of guys, those are areas where they would stand around the briar talking to their friends, pretending they know what they're talking about very often. And if you walked up and you said, no, actually, let me tell you about how quarks work inside the nucleus, it would kind of make them feel like they were idiots, which they probably were. Is it hard to have relationships? When you're working as hard as this? Married.
Married.
Married, Harshna.
No. Well, okay.
You're married to a scientist?
No, I'm not married to a scientist. But also, I was dating him for a really long time also. Okay. Childhood, high school.
Oh, okay,
sweetheart,
so you guys
thing,
so you knew each other for a long
time.
Yeah,
and he's been through my whole science journey. In fact, I think when I started dating him, I didn't really know.
Must
I'd
be proud
doing
of
physics.
You.
He is.
What
yeah.
does he do?
He has a family business. They sell textiles.
Okay.
M&P Chicken, if anyone wants fabrics.
Sure, there we go. Give it a plug. We need to pump up our fabric industry in South Africa.
Yeah,
right?
Actually, they sell really nice shwishwe fabric, which so I made a nice little African suit for the award ceremony. I was like, yeah, I'm going to be that, you know.
Good for you. And Marilise, what about you?
I'm not in a relationship at the moment. It's not that I'm against.
Don't feel bad,
anything.
Me neither.
No. Okay. For me, at the moment, I'm focusing on establishing my research and my career. And then afterwards, yeah, consider
see what
a relationship.
Happens. Because,
yes.
I mean, that's also a relevant factor. And you know, for a lot of people who want everything to be political and who talk about everything being about the number of women or the number of men in every field, for them it's not about those people's individual choices. What if one of you decided that you did also want to be a mom? That's kind of a difficult thing to juggle with what
yes,
you both do,
extremely.
Right?
Yes.
And it's not so difficult for a man. That's
yes.
the reality.
Like, I think that was the biggest talking point at the we had a little leadership seminar given by the L'Oreal Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the biggest talking points that came up with a lot of the ladies, the fellow awardees, was the struggle that they had between managing with like family life, mm-hmm. especially those who had children, and their careers. Because there's also that guilt aspect if like mm-hmm. you're giving too much attention to your work and neglecting the kids, or vice versa, giving mm-hmm. too much attention to your kids and neglecting your work. And, yeah, I think it's a difficult, that's one of the difficulties that I know I've been thinking a lot about as well. Cause, yeah, my career's on a good path and like, I don't want to step back too much from it, but how do I juggle the two?
Well, you were recently awarded the NRF Scarce Skills Doctoral Scholarship. You
yes.
previously won the Element 6 Diamond Research Laboratory and DST NRF Center of Excellence in Strong Materials Gold Medal. What strong materials are we talking about? Yeah, this is another area. This is not nuclear physics.
Well, strong. This was pertaining to the project I also continued for my master's,
yeah.
which was what I did also for as affiliated with the CERN Atlas Group.
Okay.
So there, strong materials in my case, which became a very flexible term for me, but strong materials would be anything that exhibits like hard properties, so like strength maybe in radiation hardness or in like some kind of property that it's really good at.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's quite a broad term to discuss.
Is this possibly an area where your two fields intersect? Because strong materials could be strong in terms of absorption. In your case of neutrons, maybe.
Yes, radiation absorption. Or also just like if in the piping systems, if you needed certain types of materials in aircraft. And I guess heat transfer also comes into play there, because a lot of what determines these properties as being strong or brittle also has to do with the way heat propagates through them. But if you want to know a cool thing about heat transfer applicable to like fundamental science also.
Yes.
What's really cool is when you start talking about the quark gluon plasma. So if you give enough energy, they talk about this quark gluon soup.
Yes.
And you can actually investigate its behavior, which is what they currently do, through hydrodynamics, which is considering it as being a fluid that flows. So most of the thermal and hydrodynamics that she uses.
I have to get it into my head that the nucleus isn't even solid necessarily.
Well, when you start giving it enough energy that like all of these fundamental particles have so much of energy, they now no longer start behaving in that bound system. It's like, now I have so much of energy. I don't want to be chilling with you
guys.
What
is this neutron? What is the neutron skin while we're on this?
The neutron skin. Okay. So earlier when I spoke about when you do these collision experiments, you give energy to the nucleus.
Mm-hmm.
The nucleus as a whole starts vibrating collectively. But there's different kinds of vibrational modes. So in some instances, the type of vibration I'm looking at is called a pygmy dipole resonance. What that means is you can picture it as being like a blob of protons and neutrons acting as a bounce system and vibrating against the extra neutrons that are in the nucleus.
From which it might steal or throw out quarks and share them. And
yes.
Is that where it
is?
Yeah,
but now we're looking at it like we're looking at it in terms of like where the neutrons and protons are acting more like bound systems.
Okay.
Yeah, so less energy given to them. And then in that case, all the extra neutrons kind of are on the more towards the surface of the nucleus.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can talk about that being a neutron skin.
Okay.
Yes. And that's interesting to study because in understanding how that behaves, we can then try to predict behaviors of things like neutron stars. So you can think of the nucleus as like a small little microscopic system, and just blow that whole thing up. And basically what's on the surface of the neutron skin is kind of like the crust of the neutron star.
Yeah.
Because it's all nuclear processes happening inside our sun and in stars.
So a neutron star is a star that has collapsed.
It's like something that's very dense.
Yeah.
Yes. So it will burn super hot. And you can think of it as like if we had our sun.
Yes.
But then squash it down to the size of Gauteng. So imagine the size of the sun being Gauteng, but all of the matter inside of it being so dense and squashed together, and it becomes supremely hot.
So it has tremendous gravity.
Yes.
And it has a huge amount of pressure.
Extremely hot.
And the kinds of heat that Marlies doesn't want to deal with in her lab.
Yes.
Not at all.
And so what was also interesting is I think there was that experiment just last year between LIGO and the gravitational wave experiment. So they detected gravitational waves,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, they got all of these astrophysicists with big telescopes.
Gravitational waves?
Yes.
Just explain this to me. No. I mean, in a simple, like, you have to really dumb this down for me. Gravitational waves, are these the signatures of where gravity lives?
It's not directly related to gravity. It's got to do with, like, I'm really terrible at explaining this. Not a theoretician.
Okay. Well, you know what?
But basically, like, it's got to do with, like, mass propagating over time. And, like, you'll have, like, we start talking about space and time dilation. I'm not good at explaining this part.
We'll park that one for next time.
Yes.
But you mentioned mass and gravity and time and all of this stuff. Have we found any situations where Einstein's theories are no longer valid?
Well, so that experiment actually just proved one of
Einstein's relativity.
It was evidence of his gravitational wave theory.
Now, that's incredible.
Yes.
Because that means it's something that you guys are working on in your various fields now.
Yeah, it could be something
that could be tested in 100 years from now.
Yes.
And still be valid.
So what's cool is that this event actually that they witnessed was a merger of two neutron stars, which would have happened 3 billion light years ago.
Yes, because of course we're seeing the light from it now.
Yeah, we're seeing the light from it now. But they also managed to detect these gravitational waves and then also look at the light coming from it. So all the telescopes zoned in on the region they thought they should look at and started finding all the light, and they got to see the signature from like the very energetic light, so with the different wavelengths of light, basically. But then with the wavelengths, you can tell the energy all the way from like bright light till like the infrared. They could measure those signals. And what was cool is that was the first time they saw an event which explains how all of our elements heavier than iron are actually produced. Because before we knew that like just simple star mergers and stuff could give rise to the basic elements up until iron.
Through
but
fusion.
Nothing heavier.
Through fusion, right?
Yes, there's fusion and, yes, fusion processes.
And then after iron, they discovered that this can only happen in what, neutron stars?
Well, it's like it could happen in star mergers, but not in the amounts that we actually see, not in the abundance of elements that we see.
Why is the border at iron?
It's okay. It gets quite complicated then. It's got to do with the actual nucleus.
I mean, a lot of our planet's made of iron, right? Our core.
Yes.
And it's
got to do with how much of energy is needed then for more fusion to take place also. Oh,
so should we be a little more respectful of nickel and everything else.
Yes. I think all of the elements, though.
Yeah, I love this. Yes. This is great. All right, listen, I'm gonna keep you guys here until you're blue in the face. Marilise, I'm so impressed with what you're doing. And congratulations to you. I've also just got to give a little bit of kudos here, because this is you both have so many awards. You're involved in two international research projects at the moment, the Thermosmart Horizon 2020 project, which has 1.5 million euros in funding and involves 18 universities across 5 continents, a Royal Society-funded collaboration between Imperial College London and the universities of Pretoria, Mauritius, and Nigeria. And you've produced 5 publications, 17 conference papers, and a further 4 publications are in the pipeline.
Yeah, 2 of those 4 got published now, so luckily.
Gee, wow. I don't know. I feel like a terrible underachiever.
It's a privilege for me to be able to publish the research and for others to learn from it, because there's many things that keep a lot of people wondering and they couldn't really understand it, and now all of a sudden, oh, it makes sense. So I think it's moments like these that just confirms to me that I'm definitely at the right place.
We're so happy that you're in South Africa doing the work that both of you are doing. Both Dr. Marilise Evarts and Harsha Jivan have both been recognized in the Women in Science program, which is a partnership by UNESCO and the L'Oréal Foundation. And I think this is just great. And please carry on your good work and come and visit us again.
Thank you.
I'll expect you to explain gravitational waves to me next time. Right.
Yes, I have to think of a better explanation for it then.
This is great. All right, I think we've probably put a few people to sleep, but I've loved this.
Okay.
I'm not going to apologize. All right, very, very good, ladies. Thank you so much. Have an excellent day. And are you both off to continue research and do some work today? What's the rest of the day like?
Yes, back to work. Campus.
Back to work. All right, off you go. Let's make it happen. This is CliffCentral.com.